on radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. Tonight on Right on Radio, I talk with Harold Holzer about his latest book, Presidents vs. the Press. In this remarkable new history, we examine the dual rise of the American presidency and the media that shaped it. From Washington to Trump, Holzer chronicles the disputes and distrust between these core institutions, revealing the essence of their confrontation is built into the fabric of the nation.
In the last part of the hour, Annie speaks with Vanessa Veselica about her latest novel, The Great Offshore Grounds. She is the author of the novel Zazen, which won the Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize. Her short stories have appeared in Tin House and Zazaeva, and her nonfiction in GQ, The Atlantic, and The Atavist. She has been at various times a teenage runaway, a sex worker, a union organizer, a musician, a train hopper, a waitress, and a mother. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
All right. Harold, whenever you're ready, you begin with your reading.
All right. One afternoon early in his presidency, Theodore Roosevelt summoned journalists to his White House office and gave them a special opportunity to hear him and jot down his latest thoughts, provided they could keep up with his galloping mind. What made this session unique was not just that it offered the correspondents spontaneous access. It was that the president conducted the entire briefing while his barber, an African-American Treasury Department messenger named Delaney, gave him his regular midday shave. TR decided that the casual gathering should become his routine. The sessions became known to the correspondents as the barber's hour. At 1 o'clock every afternoon, the reporters would file into a narrow room connecting the president's office to that of his secretary. There they'd find TR in a large armchair, his face covered with lather and Delaney's razor sweeping over it. Whenever a particular inquiry aroused him, the president would leap from his chair, clutching his towel, and hold forth until he calmed down. "Steady, Mr. President," Delaney would plead, blade in hand, struggling to hold Roosevelt down for fear an unexpected gesture would slit his throat.
Very good. This is Right on Radio. Today, I'm speaking with Harold Holzer about his latest work, The Presidents vs. the Press. Mr. Holzer is one of the nation's leading authorities on Abraham Lincoln and the political culture of the Civil War era. He currently serves as the director of the Roosevelt House Public Policy Institute at Hunter College, New York, and is recipient of the 2015 Gilder Lehrman Lincoln Prize. Thank you for being on Right Now Radio, Mr. Holzer.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
So your book, it presents a cogent argument that there's an indelible relationship between political journalism in America and its ability to challenge our presidents since the founding era. How is this confrontation built into the fabric of our nation from the beginning?
Well, I don't think it was the exact beginning, because George Washington had the longest press honeymoon in history, 3 full years during which he remained the unassailable icon that he had been since succeeding in the Revolutionary War. But toward the end of his first term, his own Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, invited a New York journalist to set up a new anti-federalist newspaper in Philadelphia. And he also gave him a job in the State Department to carry on a vendetta against the president. And for the next 4.5 years, Washington was subjected to such intense criticism. I mean, about his honor, about whether he was stealing money from the Treasury for padding his expense account, holding himself up as a god before Americans, that I think if you read the first draft of his farewell address, you'll see that he mentions the outrages of the press as one of the reasons he is saying adieu to the presidency. And I think that, more than his desire to not have a monarchy, is why he gave up the presidency after 2 terms.
I was wondering if you could talk about this character that was drawn up on him in the Philadelphia Aurora. There's an episode you describe in the book with Washington. He discovered this character of him written, and Jefferson observed that Washington got into one of those passions when he cannot command himself.
Right. Washington had a temper, which his contemporaries, those who knew him, were quite cognizant of. Anyway, he saw this character of him going to the guillotine. And this newspaper, the Aurora, published, to his horror, by Benjamin Franklin's grandson, and which had criticized him constantly. He threw it to the floor, and he basically jumped up and down on it with his boots and crushed it to the floor. And Jefferson, who in a sense was the cause of the criticism, he inspired partisan journalism, just watched sort of amused by this display of temper. I think he kind of got off on it, to use a contemporary expression. But it characterized how voluble and how testy the relationship with the president's, with the president and his journalistic critics had become.
Okay, I want to ask you about this now. The publisher of the Aurora was Benjamin Franklin Bach, who you just mentioned was a grandson of Ben Franklin.
Right.
What do you think Ben Franklin's response would have been if he saw his grandson's attacks on George Washington, or just his the content the Aurora put out in that time?
Yeah, you know, every generation is, that's a really great question. It's probably scandalized by the, what the next generation does. But I don't know, Franklin probably would have been sheepish about it, because it was he who trained his young Ben in publishing and printing. He gave him, you know, not only a European education, but a professional education in how to print and publish a newspaper. So I hope he would have felt guilty, because I think the Aurora was just a staggeringly negative attack dog newspaper. They employed a journalist named James Callender, who leveled most of the vicious attacks on Washington, trailing him all the way back to Mount Vernon and even into his post-presidency. And the Republicans / Democrats, the opposition, were thrilled with him. But one day, to show how partisan that the partisan press had become, Callender relocated to Richmond, Virginia, and asked now President Jefferson for a job as postmaster of Richmond. Not a hard thing to do. I mean, Jefferson had supported journalists in the past, had given them jobs. And it was time to get Federalists out of federal jobs and put Democrats in. It's interesting. This is all about the post office, which is all we're hearing about these days. Mm-hmm. Jefferson didn't like the way Callender asked. He said no. Callender, the longtime Republican editor, suddenly became a Federalist editor, began attacking Jefferson. And it was he who put out the pamphlet that announced to the world that Thomas Jefferson had fathered children with his enslaved young woman, Sally Hemings. So there was the first object lesson in for presidents: don't mess with the press, reward your supporters. And I think presidents from Jefferson on learned that that was the thing to do. Mm-hmm.
John Adams blamed his defeat for a second term in office on the press. Why did he feel this way?
Well, because he made a mess of the free press and the doctrine of the free press and the constitutional guarantees of freedom of the press. Adams signed and enforced a law that made it a federal crime to ridicule the president of the United States. And as absurd as that is, he prosecuted and imprisoned and fined journalists who broke that law, including the aforementioned Mr. Callender. He went to jail in Richmond for ridiculing John Adams. I once had occasion to talk with George W. Bush about the press. I recount this anecdote in my book. And he told me he had just read David McCullough's biography of John Adams. He said he thought McCullough gave him a free pass on the Sedition Act. He said, look, I never put the publisher of the New York Times in jail. And then he winked. He liked to wink, if you remember. He winked and he said, not that I wouldn't like to. So Adams acted on impulses that other presidents have repressed. Even Donald Trump has repressed them. His bark is much worse than his bite on prosecuting rather than insulting the press. So Adams paid the price. The opposition press really hated him because he threatened their livelihoods, he threatened their liberty, and he threatened their pocketbook.
I'm glad you mentioned Trump, how his bark is worse than his bite. I think it's interesting how President Trump has been compared to Andrew Jackson in his politics, but right. After reading Jackson's response to criticism towards him in the press, I think it's safe to say that similar attitudes towards the press, but Jackson's actual response, though, went a little bit further.
What was Jackson's treatment of the press like? I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Well, I'll make it a sort of a Trump analogy as well. Donald Trump is routinely criticized for having a chummy relationship with Sean Hannity of Fox News. They apparently talk a few times a day, and Hannity maybe not mocks him in private, but feeds off this relationship to get exclusive conversations. Well, Andrew Jackson appropriately is Trump's hero because Jackson pioneered in this. He had journalists in the White House regularly. They became part of what was later called the kitchen cabinet because they entered the side door and not the front door of the White House. And they were advisors, they were policymakers, they were speech writers. They created a kind of the first newspaper syndicate where stories were sent throughout the country based on what Jackson's loyal paper said. He rewarded the publisher with government printing contracts and access. But these guys got real federal jobs. One named Isaac Hill became comptroller of the United States. Another, Amos Kendall, became postmaster general. So here we are back to the post office. They controlled the post office. And Kendall once said, maybe I should stop sending anti-Jackson newspapers through the mail. He actually thought of that. So again, this unique confluence of presidents, press, and post office, not to sound too alliterative, is not new.
I want to go back a second here and ask you about Thomas Jefferson. Right. He was attacking the press perhaps more than any president before him, yet he held a firm belief that the federal government couldn't prevent a newspaper from printing opinions. Why was Jefferson so different in his response to the press compared to Washington or Adams?
So I think you're right about a difference, but it's maybe more of a distinction without a difference. Jefferson said amazingly informed and liberal things, I mean small L liberal, about the freedom of the press. He said, if I had to choose between free government and free press, I choose the free press. Said that the press was the toxin of liberty. It was the alarm bell that would preserve American freedom. But at the same time, he did crack down on the press in his own way. Yes, he thought that journalists could print things, but he also believed that they should be prosecuted for libel for printing what they printed. The big difference between Jefferson and Jackson is A, Jefferson said good things about press freedom, but that Adams thought the federal government should prosecute the press. Jefferson, who was a states' rights man, thought that state libel laws should be pursued. And he encouraged state libel prosecution against anti-Jefferson newspapers. As always with Jefferson, I mean, I said Trump's bark is worse than his bite. Jefferson's idealism is much more elevated than his reality. I sort of compare his belief in a free press and the way he behaved to his, you know, brilliant wordsmithing in the Declaration. He said he believed that all men are created equal, but he didn't practice what he preached in real life. So I think that was sort of the way he dealt with the press.
I want to ask you now about Abraham Lincoln and what I did not realize until reading your book, his unconstitutional actions towards the press. He arrested and imprisoned many editors and took control of all the telegraph lines in the United States during the Civil War, and nearly 200 papers were subjugated under his administration.
Right.
Why did Lincoln believe this was necessary to preserve the Union?
Well, he put it in, once said, must I shoot a simple-minded soldier boy for deserting and spare the wily agitator who induces him to desert? And with that aphorism, he meant newspaper men could be provocateurs who discouraged enlistment, who encouraged desertion, and they had to be suppressed. You had to drop enforcement of one aspect of the Constitution, freedom of the press, in order to save the entire Constitution from rebellion and civil war. The Supreme Court later said he had no justification for conducting military trials and imprisonment without charge against editors. But by then the war was over and he was dead. So in a way, there was no judicial or legislative pushback against his censorship. He argued that the Civil War gave him a unique power not only to be commander-in-chief, but to be censor-in-chief. And no one ever prosecuted more or saw to the prosecution of more newspapers and editors than Abraham Lincoln in the end. At the same time, he was a master of maintaining friendly relations with editors. In his reelection campaign, in the space of about a month, he ordered the imprisonment of two New York editors, including the editor of a powerful Democratic Party daily, the New York World. But when it came to the Republican daily, the New York Times, he made its editor the chairman of the Republican National Committee. So how's that for an interweaving and a sort of a schizophrenic attitude toward journalism?
One of the best presidents, I think, who had the best relationship, it seemed to be, with the press was Theodore Roosevelt, you mentioned, who you did a great reading at the beginning. He was very invested in press management more than any president before him. Why was galvanizing public support so essential for him?
Well, first of all, he lived through the decline of the big editor publishers and the partisan nature of their work. He came to the presidency in the age more of yellow journalism and front page journalism. He had seen yellow journalism provoke the Spanish-American War in the administration of his predecessor. And he wanted to, you know, in the same manner in which, as someone once said, he needed to be the bride at every wedding and the baby at every christening and the corpse at every funeral, he also wanted and expected to be on the front page of every newspaper every day, every week. He knew that front pages is what the nation looked at now more than editorials. He made news, he befriended reporters. So he was into daily journalism with leaks and trial balloons and something called swamping. When somebody else had a story, he would issue a bigger story to dominate the news. It was the dawn of spontaneous photography. He would delay events if a photographer was delayed to make sure he was covered adequately in the press. And at the same time, he encouraged long-form journalism to investigate the meatpacking industry, the oil industry. He worked hand-in-hand with Ida Tarbell and Lincoln Steffens. And when he thought he had milked them to what they were worth, he dropped them and condemned them as muckrakers. They're known as the muckrakers, saying it's almost a badge of honor, but he didn't mean it as such. So he's pretty ruthless with the way he dealt with the press. But they loved him because he was a character, and they needed characters to write about.
Yeah. In an unusual instance of the press respecting the wishes of a president, there was an understanding between the press and Franklin Roosevelt that he would not be pictured showing his handicap. How come?
You know, I looked everywhere for, I guess, a smoking gun. What was the deal they struck? And every reminiscence I found from a photographer was, gee, you know, he was such a nice guy and he was so nice to us and he was only trying to help the country. Why should we put something else in his way? And, but at the beginning, it was this extraordinary gentleman's agreement. Ultimately, the administration did push and crack down on anybody who left the fold. I mean, FDR was there for a very long time and control and friendships began to ease after the passage of 8-9 years, inevitably. But it's an extraordinary thing that they protected him. No shots in his wheelchair. The ones who did were banished, really, the ones who violated the gentleman's agreement. No shots of him being lifted in and out of automobiles. And the question remains, did the public have a right to know? Or was it entirely private? We all remember, I hope we remember, 4 years ago, Donald Trump's doctor drove up to Trump Tower and handed out a health report that said he was the healthiest patient he had ever treated, and then he drove away. And that was his official health report. Franklin Roosevelt got a reporter for a magazine to investigate his health and then got three doctors to write that he was the healthiest patient they had, not mentioning his handicap and not mentioning his heart disease and his high blood pressure. And then the one who wrote the story wrote a letter to FDR and said, we really got it done, didn't we? So this friendly conspiracy, probably without it, he might not have been president, because Herbert Hoover, who exercised every day in front of the press. It was called the Medicine Ball Club. They threw a medicine ball around, was hoping that he could make an issue out of Roosevelt's disability.
Many critics of President Trump have complained he circumvents the press to deploy his message through Twitter to the public directly. What you show is that he wasn't the first president to do this and certainly won't be the last. FDR's embrace of radio was an attempt to render the print press irrelevant. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, there are three or four presidents who stand out. Five, if you start with Lincoln and his use of the telegraph wires that, as you pointed out, the Union, the government commandeered. He sent out lots of messages on the telegraph. But FDR combined access with circumvention. He held 998 press conferences during his presidency, two a week most of the time, which is an extraordinary degree of access that had been unprecedented. They were off the record, and they could get a little brittle, as Trump's do. He once told a journalist to go stand in the corner, which is like Trump saying you're a wise guy or you're a nasty woman, I suppose. But yeah, he was a master of the radio. And by the way, that began from the place I work in, Roosevelt House at Hunter College. Roosevelt House was FDR's New York City home. It's where he ran his 1932 campaign. And on the day after his election, he went to his parlor and did an address on radio to assure the nation that he would protect them in this hour of need during the Depression. And then after he became president, he delivered 28 of these kind of intimate, conversational, but very well-rehearsed fireside chats. And he was just a master of the medium. Some people are great on radio and television, and some aren't. Look at the difference between Richard Nixon on television and John Kennedy on television. Kennedy, soaring from those televised debates in 1960, which I watched as a kid on black and white TV, he introduced televised live news conferences, and that was another circumvention in a way, and the press didn't like it. They complained about the televised news conference. One reporter said it was like watching Kennedy make love in Carnegie Hall, which I think may have had a double meaning, because the press was also protecting Kennedy from stories about his personal life, which they were well aware of, because he was pals with a lot of editors and journalists. The televised news conference became appealing to reporters when they got TV time. Obama used the White House website in much the same way. Reporters found eventually that his press office would not answer questions. They would refer reporters to a televised message on the website, and they did not like being circumvented in that way. Trump is like Roosevelt in one way. I'm trying not to choke on those words, but he's like Roosevelt in one way. He is accessible for sure. He may be engaged in a joust, in a battle with each press conference and each scrum, but you can't say he's hiding. He's there. He's taking the questions. He loves the fight. And at the same time, he's circumventing the press by doing his messaging, you know, his avalanche of messaging almost every morning with the inevitable daily tweet storm, which, by the way, the press allows to become the main story every morning. Mm-hmm. So in a way, they're complicit in allowing him this, you know, the dominance that he enjoys.
With the growing importance of the internet and the global reach of social media, websites like Facebook and Twitter and TikTok, do you predict we'll see more efforts by future presidents in deploying robust marketing efforts online and promoting their agenda?
I think absolutely. I think if Joe Biden wins, I think his team will do it. I think he has called himself a transitional candidate. I think he'll be somewhat transitional about the internet as well. I don't see him spending his mornings, watching MSNBC and then calling in on the phone and tweeting. But I think inevitably the next generation of leaders are going to catch on to whatever is the platform of the day. It probably won't be Twitter. I mean, who would have predicted Twitter 10 years ago? Who would have predicted the internet 20 years ago? Something will devolve. And for one, I hope it doesn't involve pressing any buttons. I hope you can just like tap your eyeglasses and say, come in, Mr. President or Madam President, but we will see. Yes, I think it's important. Every president from here on in is going to have to find the platform that he or she is suited to.
My last question for you, and maybe the most difficult one. Should U.S. presidents, do they always need to be prepared to counter criticism from the press? And is it always the press's responsibility to uncover transgressions of a president?
So I think, yes, the president has to be on his or her guard all the time. But that's part of the balance. They don't call the press the fourth estate for nothing. It's like the fourth branch of government. It's the truth-telling branch. It's the spotlight branch. If hearings don't work, if judicial review doesn't work, the press is there to aim a relentless spotlight. The press is there to investigate, to inquire, to press. They're not there always to do gotcha journalism. And I think since Nixon's downfall, which the press took a lot of deserved credit for, there has been an effort to overdo scrutiny and to make it into I gotcha. And I think, you know, my own view, and it may not be shared by others, is that the impeachment of Bill Clinton was a result of journalistic overreach. But then again, his defeating the impeachment effort is an example of a president who battles press scrutiny and wins. So I think it can go both ways, and that's the way it should be.
We are out of time. Harold Holzer, thanks so much for being here on Right on Radio with us.
Josh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And now this.
This is Annie Harview on KFAI 90.3 FM. Is this Vanessa Veselka?
Yes. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Thank you so much for the station. I really loved the great offshore grounds, and I'm so excited to have you here tonight. Could you start us off?
Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Could you start us off by briefly kind of describing the story and premise in your own words?
Sure. The Great Offshore Grounds is a novel that follows two sisters, primarily Livy and Cheyenne, as they make their way through late stage capitalism and try to find their way in the world. They don't have a lot of resources and they're not sure where they fit. But it is also it also has to do with the American Project, and they travel, there are road trips. There's even a sea story, but it's characters at the heart of the story for sure.
Yeah, I totally agree. Do you have a short passage that you'd like to read to start us off?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I'll read a little bit from the beginning.
Perfect.
And I'll start there.
Thanks so much.
So, sure. 15 miles south of Seattle and halfway across Puget Sound to the west is Maury Island, shaped like an arrowhead aimed at the mainland. Green is the inner fold of a grass blade. It can be seen from the air, cradled in a crook of an elbow of water. Tourists ride over in ferries to watch for whales and UFOs. Jets turn around overhead on their final approach to the airport. Even on days when there is no rain, mist filters through the evergreens until it pulls apart like threadbare cloth and burns off. The wedding was to be held in the afternoon at Point Robinson, the site of an old fog signal station that once housed steam whistles, fed by coal fire and water to warn away ships. In 1897, at the dawn of massive capital expansion and speculation, the whistle sounded for 528 hours, nearly killing the man who had to shovel the 35 tons of coal. Still, the cargo had to be kept from the rocks. Who can halt the lumbering desires of the world? In 1915, the lighthouse with its state-of-the-art fifth-order Fresnel lens was built. Powered initially by oil vapor lamps, its beacon could be seen for 12 miles. The lens was the perfect manifestation of Victorian technology, replacing simple flat lenses with faceted crystal domes, prisms cut in the tiers that made it both astonishingly beautiful and a breakthrough in optics. The Fresnel lens had a theoretically infinite capacity to capture diffuse light and, by way of internal reflection, cast it like a spear through darkness. It lit stages in celluloid, Polaroid shots in the retinas of ID, for ID scans. And on Point Robinson, it lit Puget Sound. Back across the Sound in Seattle, Livy looked out the window of her basement apartment. Her father was getting married that afternoon, and though it was already late April, a cold, wet breeze still whistled through the gaps in the caulking, turning her skin to goose flesh. A few feet away stood her sister, Cheyenne, poorly slept, but already dressed. "I'm freezing," said Cheyenne. "I'm turning on the space heater." "Turn on the oven. They charge us for electricity," said Livy. Cheyenne rolled her eyes, but went over to the little white gas stove. Cranking the temperature to broil, she leaned back against the oven's door so she could feel the heat on her hamstrings while it warmed. Yesterday, they'd spent the whole day picking rocks out of Livy's landlord's garden in trade for a patch of soil near the sunny side of the fence so that Livy could grow food. It wasn't political. Livy didn't care about pesticides or permaculture. She was just the cheapest person Cheyenne had ever known. She lived off past date groceries. She washed her clothes once a month and a teaspoon of dish soap in the tub. She made her own bras. Cheyenne was pretty sure she would have rinsed and reused dental dams if she thought it would work. Recently, Livy had become convinced that she could feed herself off 3 square yards of land. It was ridiculous. But since Cheyenne had appeared out of nowhere and moved in on her without warning or rent, she didn't have much of a say. Taller and unfreckled, Cheyenne had chosen a rose-colored cap-sleeve shirt with eyelets and a pair of black pinstriped stoop pants. She could pass in the crowd they'd be in today. Her secondhand clothes came off as vintage, while her misadventures in body art made her seem a fine vase, badly cracked and chipping, but a gritty accent to any room. "Cyril didn't come to my wedding," said Cheyenne. "Why should I go to his?" "Did you invite him?" "Oh, hell no. He would have arrived like the Lord and expected to walk me down the aisle. Here, let me give you away." "Oh, hey, Dad, I'm pretty sure you already did that." "You're right," said Livy. "He would have. So why are we even going?" "I have a day off work and it's cheaper than a movie. I'm tired of ramen and hot dogs and there'll be rich people food, so I'm taking Tupperware." "Please don't make it obvious," said Cheyenne. "We're already going to look so out of place." "Oh, because you have jailhouse tattoos of hearts and clubs on your knuckles, or because I don't shave and look like a landscaper?" Cheyenne spread the fingers of her left hand. "Not just clubs and hearts. The one on my thumb is a diamond and the pinky is a spade. You just can't tell anymore." Livy crossed where she'd laid out her newly washed blue painter's pants and pulled them on over her long johns. "I'm going to the wedding because it's a show of support that costs me nothing. I've never thought of him as a dad, so I don't care. At his worst, he's a big blank, a disappointment. He gets a clean slate. That's my wedding present, a pass. It's the only decent move." "I shot my better angel," said Cheyenne. "They're angels. You can't kill them." "If they were real, you could." So I'll just stop there.
Thank you. I think that was an excellent passage to introduce the family dynamics in this book. a combination of protecting each other at all costs, but also roasting each other to pieces. I also want to point out the way that that passage so wonderfully brought us into the descriptions of social inequity and life as a low-income person in America, which I'd love to talk about with you in a little more detail. The descriptions of social inequity, including income inequity and healthcare problems in this novel, are some of the most realistic and gripping I've read in a novel. And for those who haven't read or finished, oh, you're welcome. For those who haven't read or finished the book yet, one character, their mother, Kristen, decides not to pursue cancer treatment because of the extremely high cost. The the boy they took in as a sort of brother, Essex, joins the Marines for stability because he'd never really had that kind of income or health care before. And I just wanted to know, was watching people navigate the challenges of income inequality in very different ways a goal of this writing project for you? Or was that something that happened along the way as you built out the nuance of these people's stories?
It just felt very natural. Like many people, most of my life I've sort of, you know, hand to mouth on a lot of it. Now, I've had more privilege than others in many ways. But, you know, I've worked a lot of different jobs, and they weren't for experience.
Yeah.
They were for money. They were like, you know, I've driven cabs. I didn't have health insurance most of my life. You know, I didn't have like a lot of these things. You know, I've had different experiences with, and I've been around many people for whom, you know, had a friend, two really good friends in a car wreck, bad car wreck last week. And the very first thing is both of us said, oh my God, do they have health insurance?
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And nobody, like everybody, we're just telling them, don't think about it. Don't think about it right now. We'll take care of it later. Right. Mm-hmm. How many Americans do that?
Yeah.
So to me, it wasn't a construction of I want to illustrate this. It was the natural outcropping of these are the people I know.
Yeah.
These are the people I care about. Mm-hmm. And then as the characters sort of came out, they had their own way of expressing how that would show up in different parts of their life. I would say that, you know, I knew very early on that I was writing characters that it was going to go into class, that it was going to go into, you know, where we are in this moment in time, what people make of it, and American myths and what they mean.
Yeah. Well, I think that the book really made me think about decisions of stability and ways that people have less or more freedom to pursue safety, pursue health care, things like that, depending on situations they're born or forced into. On a similar note, as you were talking about finding the characters where they are, it felt to me like a lot of the characters were approaching the concepts of freedom versus like safety and stability in very different kinds of trade-offs. For example, there were characters who would give themselves the stability and material means to make travel and healthcare and nutrition and debt repayment possible, like Essex joining the military, not because he especially cares about the Marines, but because it was a structure with which he could tie up his loose ends and other people's, versus like Livy, who has very few permanent commitments, cruises in and out of salmon ship jobs as she'd like to, but also lacks health care and stable income and goes a lot of the book without a phone in the 21st century, which is a little unthinkable for a lot of people. Do you think that your characters felt like they were pursuing the same concept, like freedom, in different ways? Or do you think they perceived their life choices without more abstract thoughts like, what am I trading off freedom and stability?
I don't think these are characters that have ever known stability. You know, I was speaking to somebody about them at one point. They said, well, it's really surprising because poor people usually, you know, can't move around or don't move around. They're like setting aside refugee status, right?
Oh.
And I thought, well, that's not true. Most people I know who have been and grown up in that way, they move about 3 or 4 times a year, depending on evictions, you know, depending on changes in circumstance, depending on a variety of things. So it's actually, I think maybe when you really look at it, it's more constant motion, right?
Yeah.
And so in a space of constant motion, constant schools, constant, you know, all sorts of things, that change is always there. I don't think my characters think of stability in the same way. I think they don't expect it in that sense. However, with Livy, she wants to make sure she owes no one anything.
Yeah.
She wants to support herself. In, you know, she wants a boat someday. Like, she has very simple wants, and she's willing to work really, really hard to get them. And she doesn't want anything to destabilize her. She feels her economic fragility very seriously. But in that sense, I think she has more expectation that if she does everything right, it will be right. And
Well, cool. keeping on the Livy train, much of the story hinges on the twin sisters, Livy and Cheyenne, trying to find out the truth about their origin story, because the mother who raised them, Kirsten, did not birth at least one of them, and they know that for a while. And I'll try to ask this question without spoiling too much. But the mother, they end up finding that Cheyenne finds, expresses having no regret at living her life without active involvement with that family that she helped set up, which she was aware of and knew where it was the whole time. And I personally, as who I am in the world, read that scene and found it absolutely crushing with sadness. But I suppose that others could have read it as liberating or neutral. How did it sit with you as you create it and set it up in the minds of those particular characters?
I think that crushing with sadness was the intention, but I think the other part of it that Cheyenne is, that Cheyenne has to see in that moment is more the almost gaslighting question of, are her emotions just part of her immaturity?
Yeah.
In that, you know, is there a greater freedom if she could let go of them all? Like there. So I think that that's also in that. And it's an interesting part that, you know, was part of the struggle of bringing the book, you know, into publication was that, and again, I don't want to do any spoilers. But that parts of those, it's not as straight ahead a book as it would appear to be in the beginning. You know, it's not as if there's one mystery that gets answered and that's the arc. And some of the story and of the project to me was about pulling apart the idea of a hero's journey.
Yeah.
You know, as this kind of, you know, sort of construction of capitalism in some ways. I mean, in some ways, the mother has very, I think, astutely figured out that the way that she's created this origin myth for them, that she's told them. And it's meant to make them feel special. Mm-hmm. It's meant to make them feel like they have a destiny, you know, their own destiny, their own becoming that's always about to happen. And she does it for all the right reasons. She does it because she looks around and she goes, she identifies that as the place where people with more means and more privilege have the edge on everybody. They actually believe that they can do something great. They believe the world is waiting for them. They believe all of these other parts. Mm-hmm. And so she wants to try to instill something like that so her girls will believe that too. And it kind of backfires. There's a lot of emotions around it. And so this idea of, you know, how myth affects us, whether it's personal myth, whether it's national myth, And whether it's a good or bad thing is pretty central to the novel as well.
Yeah. A big reason that I even wanted to interview about this book is because I began reading it, thought I knew exactly where it was going to go. And then it continued to go in like a larger and larger constellation of nuances and possibilities and ways that different segments of the American population and American society interact with each other. And I just want to say that for anyone who that last question really sold you on thinking through kind of those dichotomies of what your life is and what connections and options are, I could not recommend this book more. And I'm super excited to be in this conversation. To really drastically change the topic. There are ghosts in this book. They don't play a huge role, but it was a fun reading experience where everything felt relatively realistic, sometimes crushingly realistic. And then all of a sudden, a character would encounter a ghost. And I was just wondering, from a creative standpoint, why and how did you decide to throw some ghosts in here and there?
Well, the America of the novel is a combination of place and history.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more of an ambient factor than it is, you know, directly there, but occasionally I think it steps into the narrative differently.
Yeah.
And I think that the way I look at language and writing is I'm always trying to describe something sometimes that's hard to describe, and I'm trying to get at it, and I'm trying to get at it. You know, it's like, and sometimes the language I have available to me doesn't feel like it's sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
And I reach for something that's a little more figurative, or I reach, you know, for something that's, you know, and so there are two small ghosts, but there are two main ghosts in the novel. Mm-hmm. One is Sir Walter Raleigh, and one is John Arthur Le Jeune, who was a Marine. And they both have to do with, you know, colonialism and imperialism, but they also are lost things upon the land. They're sort of, and I think my initial writing of them, I do a lot of free writing. I don't sit and plot things out that way. So they came to me as unexpectedly, you know, and I began to write into them and see what they had and what they had to say. But I think it's also just that there is a conversation that's always going back and forth, a call and response to the nature of America, about history, about whose it is, about who has the right to tell that story, you know. And so this is a, you know, there's a very complex relationship with, you know, they're never far in the novel from stolen land.
Yeah,
you know, they walk through it like they are never far. Like there's echoes of the Confederacy. There's echoes, you know. I mean, and all sorts of. I mean, like there's, you know, there's Raleigh. There's not a way that. That's one of the parts of the book is they are on one hand inheriting all of American history.
Mm-hmm.
They're Americans and they're born into this land,
mm-hmm.
and on the other hand, they're trying to figure out what histories and what myths are theirs to take and what are theirs to leave. And I have a deep anxiety about reinvention. I think it can be so brilliant, and I think it can also be so dangerous as a way of sort of cutting responsibility or cutting complicity, or, you know. And so I think all of those things run through the book, and the ghosts hold some of that.
Yeah, I definitely appreciated that, the way that it kind of drew you into America as a whole. Livy in the novel, who calls herself not political and doesn't vote or really make much of an effort to participate in larger society, chooses to join a protest action when motivated by someone she loves. Do you think that having love and kind of a future to look forward to with that person motivated her to, quote unquote, be political on a personal level? Or do you think that she was kind of participating in this larger action to learn about and engage with her loved one's values? Or do you think she kind of had a shift of what political might mean?
I know this one for a fact. She did not have a shift about what political might mean. She did it straight up for love.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I was curious about that is, you know, my father years ago, you know, there was, I want to share all the, say this as respectfully as possible, but my father was very political, and he was in an environment with, where he's working with a particular Indian tribe, and for a while, and got very close and stayed close for years and years and years, and had done a lot of work that was honored and respected for the tribe and in that situation. And I had always assumed so, and then my father was adopted ceremonially into this tribe. And I'd always assumed that it was for the work that he did.
Mm-hmm.
Years later, I come to find out that while that was part of it, the man whose mother adopted him, was deeply in love with him and unable to come out. And I think becoming brothers was the closest they could be. And that struck me so much because I thought, how many times do we think something is done for one reason when it's done for another? How many times did I think that something was done for a overtly political reason in another context, that was really done out of a desire for closeness And I thought about that with ethics, and I thought about that, you know, you hear people in the military talk about that all the time. I don't believe in this, I don't believe in that, but I believe in the person next to me.
Yeah.
And again, that's one of those things that I think is a horrible bind, and a mm-hmm. beautiful bind, and a horrible bind. You know, it's not. So that was very much the perspective I had with Livy, was what is it like to be that person?
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. I love to hear that. We're needing to wrap things up in just a couple minutes, but I want to ask you about one of my absolute favorite moments of the book, where Cheyenne is just thinking about how terrible she feels about her life, and a stranger working in a gas station tells her, when she's talking about her worries, everybody gets a test pancake as kind of a moment of support. And I just was really struck by that moment, and I was wondering if you could talk me through how you decided to deliver the kind of more redemptive message in that way.
Yeah, that scene was one that meant a lot to me, even though it was very small, and I really fought to keep it in. There were a lot, not from my current ed, but there were a lot of iterations where, you know, it was one of those things that, it doesn't need to be there. But mm-hmm. to me, it did.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that those moments with strangers that are just simple kindness.
Yeah.
Just offering someone the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
You know, being half on their side
mm-hmm.
in a moment when they're raw can be a life-changing contact. And so in that situation, Cheyenne is very raw, and she has a very realistic and true view of all the things that she has messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And what she's been wrong about. And, you know, when she's talking about love or this or that, and the woman says, everybody, you know, well, honey, everybody gets a test pancake. There is something so generous about that statement.
Yeah.
I actually had someone say that to me once.
Oh.
And it stayed with me a long time. And so I put that in sort of as an homage to that kind of person. I don't know where I never met that person, was there for 10 seconds in their life, not 10, maybe 2 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to reflect that. So,
yeah.
So that's how that came to be in there.
Well, thank you so much. Well, leaving everyone with the thought of you get a test pancake. Vanessa, thank you so much for joining me tonight. It's been really wonderful to have you, and I cannot wait to hear all of my friends' feedback after they read this book, after hearing this. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be on. Good night.
Good night. Are listening to Write On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org.
I'm Liz Olds. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Harold Holzer and Vanessa Biscola, plus our listeners who make this show possible. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Write On Radio at kfai.com/program/writeonradio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast, found on Spotify, iTunes, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now, stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.